Kia ora whānau, nau mai haramai, a nice little turnout of us all today. Thanks for coming along this morning. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou. It is such a privilege to be sitting here alongside Luke Willis-Thompson, our artist on show, for his exhibition B4 2040 A1 A1A. Now we're sitting in a room that is about 7 meters by 6 meters. Me and Luca just at the front, next to his work. And we're going to speak for about maybe about 30, 40 minutes, and unpack some of the basics, learn a little bit about Luke, who he is, and some of his previous works introduced. And importantly, before I start, I just want to mihi to Stephen Cleland, the director of Ngutu Kaka, who's just sitting at the end of the bench over there. This is presented in partnership to realise an exhibition of this standard, a big effort. So, kia ora, Stephen. So, Luke, how are you going? How's it been coming down to Ōtautahi? It's your first time to present work here. How are you going? What's that? Was this something chill? I'm making this very official.
Tēnā rā koutou, kua hui hui, mai nei mō tēnei kiriata, Nisa Buluinaka. It's nice to be here. It's the first time I've shown work in Te Wai Pōnamu, as far as I know. And it's cool. I'm happy.
Kia ora. I wanted to do Ko Waikue, who are you? But I thought we could do this through a work that we were thinking of presenting last year, which was Movement de Mallard. And that could be a way to talk about your whakapapa and who you are. Can you just start telling me a bit about that work? Where was it made?
Who do I think I am? That work, Mouvement de Mallard, is a piece I made with the help of Stephen Cleland again. And it's really a work with three components. And the first component is a mural that Jean Charlot painted in 1963. Sorry, every date I say today is probably going to be wrong, but it was 1963, I think, and he painted this. He was a muralist. He was Mexican originally, and he ended up moving to Hawaii, and he became quite well known for depicting native life in the social realist tradition. He trained with Riviera, so he worked in this like quite incredible way. And he was sent after the Vatican II reforms, which was a moment during the Catholic Church where I suppose, you know, there were big theological questions at play, but it was also, you can also read it as a moment that the church was trying to catch up to the globalized world that was like largely seeking independence. And so part of the reforms that the Catholic Church made was that you could, or one of the reforms was that you could depict Christ in your own people's likeness. And so Jean Charlot was given this commission to go to an area of Fiji called Naiserilangi, which is an area that where I'm from, which is an island called Benga, like that's my ancestral land. They have a Yava relationship or a Naita relationship with this this area, they have a tribal kinship. And so Jean Charlot painted this mural, and it's beautiful and, you know, complicated in many ways, and it depicts Christ as a Fijian man. And then it has this scene composed around him. And what really interested me about that scene was that it is the kind of colonial order of power. Like, on one side of the mural are the Fijian, Fijian Indian people, and on one side of the native Fijian is the native Fijian side. I mean, the mixed race children are on the either edges, and the first priest of Fiji is in the painting. And so it depicts this kind of submission to Christ, and Christ obviously stands in some ways for the Western world, or that idea of enlightenment as tied to colonialism. And so this work is just the camera on each panel of the mural. And then we recorded that during a cyclone. After a small cyclone. And it was the worst floods in 20 years when we recorded it. So we mic'd the church up, which sits above this hill. And then we kind of made this portrait of the rain. The rain, of course, is this symptom of, the coming climate catastrophe or the climate catastrophe. And I had been kind of inspired to make a portrait of the rain because of the poet Dion Brand, who features really heavily in these works. And there's this conversation Deanne has where she talks about like how the natural world has been penetrated, to use an ugly word, by capitalism in every regard. And she says, but you know, maybe I could just still have the rain. And she's implying maybe the rain is still free. But of course, in a place like Fiji, the rain is like very much a symptom. So the work is like you watch this mural, which doesn't really change, but we film it for 6 hours, and you listen to the day as this storm comes, and the men get ready in the morning, and something gets built, and a baby and a dog have this long argument, and the Mynah birds scream, and the storm comes in, and it's like death metal for a couple of hours, and it passes, and it ends with this prayer. So it has this like sonic displacement going on. I mean, the last element is like maybe a long story, but I woke up one day and I was like in a hospital, and I had Fanon's tattoo, the last line of Fanon's book, Black Skin, White Masks. The line, O ma cour, faites-moi toujours un homme qui interroge. My body, make me a man who always questions. I had that like tattooed all over my legs. And I had received that tattoo when I was insane. And I had to like live on from that moment. And part of that like living on was like coming to learn that Fanon was this, I didn't know really anything about him, but I came to learn how he was a kind of radical anti-psychiatrist, and he ran a psychiatric hospital for the French regime during the Algerian War. But when he was there, he would treat the colonial oppressors in the day, and then he would sneak in the Algerian rebels at night. And so he would treat both the colonized and the colonizer. And he wrote his famous text on decolonization after going through that process. And As part of this pilgrimage to kind of better understand Fanon, because I felt like I had received his work almost like a tohu, I then went to read his archive in France, in Caen. And it was in that archive that I found this story, this fragment of a story he wrote called Les Anges, like the angels. And it's this description of what an angel is in Islamic culture. And he's writing it, I think, to kind of understand or to kind of educate his colleagues that the messengers that the patients might be being visited by aren't necessarily like bad. So that's the last element of this work. It's this copy of this Fanon letter, which I kind of smuggled out of the archive. Like I copied it, but you're not allowed to copy anything, and snuck it out. And so that is the third element, along with the rain and the thing. And there's this kind of idea in that piece that, you know, there are these two sides, and there are these two examples where people are trying to put things in the local idiom to make, you know, I love Fanon, right? I obviously do, I'm not. But that letter is still a kind of act of putting his thinking as a psychiatrist into a native discourse in order to kind of make the medicine go down better. And that's similar to the painting in the church. So I was thinking about that process of indigenizing as a way to recolonize in some ways. That was a really long answer to that.
Yeah, cool work. I think of Mason Dury and Te, was it He Whare Tapawha, as the Māori equivalent an approach to medicine that is through an indigenous, in a Māori way, really inducing those moments. So I see a slight resonance, but I'm wondering, so I can see the way that you're making that work and you're researching, and I was wondering, as we shift over to these two major works that you're presenting here today, we could easily segue through Can You Tell Me About the Title, or about was the approach and similar when making Soro and Whakamoemoea? Does it have the same question that you're asking?
Does it have the same? I mean, I'll say the title of Mouvement just to like say it. It's just from a ledger in the colonial. It's a ledger from the hospital, and it just describes the. Mouvement du Moulin is like a very old-fashioned way of saying like the comings and goings of the sick. It's like a patient ledger, but in like antiquated language. But I thought it was a bit like a dance. It sounded a bit like movement, a choreography, and then like Mala, like the afflicted, or yeah, I don't know. I guess I thought it kind of could pertain, bleed out of the hospital, and kind of think of many places as doing this dance. And to come to these works, I don't think they had this similar process. Like in that work, I was kind of like following a path. And I think it's quite a beautiful work because of the way it just sits together quite lightly. And these works aren't, don't exactly have that same lightness to them. What should I say? Where should I start?
What's the show title reference?
It's a bit stupid actually, but it's the B4A1A1A is like what's called the Polynesian motif, and it's a kind of genetic tag that is present in the genetic map of like everybody from Madagascar to Aotearoa. Like it's this thing that shows up in DNA that pertains to Polynesian people largely, Pacific people largely. And then 2040 is the day this work is set, but it's set in 2040 because Moana Jackson really wanted the 200th anniversary of the signing of Te Tiriti to kind of be the, to be a kind of like landmark event. And when he asked, a really formative moment in making this film for me was watching an interview where he's asked, like, when should Matiki Mai get started? And then he suggests 2040, but he's really talking about like a significant step, and he doesn't comment on what that step would be, but to kind of like going down the legislative path. He thought that was the right date to begin that process. And so then I wanted to think about like what it would be just to rush forward to that date, you know, like imagining having it done by 2040. And in the title, I guess I thought like putting the date in the DNA a little bit like a kind of, I don't know, activation date or something that might wake up inside, genetically coded.
For those who might not be unfamiliar with Matsuki Mai, what was the work that Jackson did?
So that's what this work is based on. He was asked by Margaret Mutu, who was the chair of the, who was the Iwi's forum chair at that time, to consider what a written constitution for Aotearoa could be. And he went away and spent 5 years, I think 2012 to 17, something like that. And he conducted like over 300 hui around the country, him and his working group, which included people like Mutu and Veronica Tafai, who both assisted on this film. And he went around the country holding these hui and then taking in these conversations, really wanting to hear from the people like how they were governed and how they felt the state in their life and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, he took these conversations back and synthesized a report and mediated on this report and came up with a suggestion for a recommendation for constitutional transformation. And in that transformation, as the film explains, the governance of the country is split, and non-Māori, or the kowangatanga sphere, can continue as a liberal democracy if that's what it wants. And then Māori would govern themselves through iwi and hapū, and the two sides would have a relational sphere where things were worked out that were kind of relevant to a national scale of things. But essentially, this breakdown of peoples would be, would have a kind of like would share parliamentary sovereignty. So what's really critical is that the non-Māori side couldn't tell Māori how to live.
Why is it important for you to make this work, and especially now?
It's a hard one because I think I think this government's assault on Māori rights and the funding of Māori, the Māori world in some ways, or the kind of like there is this incredible antagonism with that I can see between this government and the political life of, or you know, the biopolitical world basically. And so this world, I think this artwork has a kind of kick now, but it sort of precedes it. You know, I began working at this in, I don't know if a more optimistic time, but in Jacinda Ardern's prime ministership. And it actually came, it began with this idea of that I had, but I was really unwell and crazy at the time. But I was trying to work with Jacinda Ardern, and I was trying to make a film with her. I can't really remember why. And in that time, I basically started to prepare for this interview, which wasn't even happening. But I was preparing for it, and in the preparation, like basically just found Matsiki Mai and then became quite obsessed with this document. And I think like I teach a little bit and at an art school at Elam, and in that class, in the class that I've taught Matsiki Mai for like 3 years. And you know, like overwhelmingly people just feel like they're reading something that gives them hope. And that hope is like something about we are all in this country, I think, socialized from a very early age to think the inequalities in this country are intractable and somehow like natural. Like, it's horrible to even say that, but we are sort of socialized to think that you just can't do anything about radical disparities in health comes, that they must be slow moving processes. We basically just get talked out of the idea that there's any revolutionary potential in this country our whole lives. And Matsiki Mai doesn't do that. It just like very clearly shows you that the system is the problem. System is, what do you call it? All of these things that we survive are by design. And it just suggests a just way to do that, and not a perfect way to do, you know, I have respect to an anarchist sentiment, like it's still governance, it's still the state in your life or whatever, but I guess what really appeals to me about Matsiki Mai is it's like trying to imagine living for the first time in a just world.
What are we seeing behind us?
This is the star of a film, Orini Kaipara, MP for Tamaki Makaurau, but wasn't a member of parliament when we shot this. And she is in front of Te Whare Runanga, which is the whare nui at the Waitangi, on the top of the hill at the Waitangi Treaty Grounds. And I hope or wonder, like, this whare is recognisable to everyone from television, right? Like, everyone, I think, remembers this from Waitangi Day on TV. So that was part of my thinking.
Yes, I remember from childhood all of the politicians going up, from things getting thrown at them to to wondering who's going to run out crying or not be cancelled on the marae. So that, I think, It's this presentation of using, I guess, media as a, I like when I was looking through the longer history of the works you've made, there's a particular, I guess, method or way of framing your works. I think back to Human, and that was the helicopter footage. Why did you want to present this as a television announcement at Waitangi? When we were speaking yesterday, I really enjoyed the point where what we were getting towards. You were talking about it being a familiar place and format that would be able to like almost like ground it to or make it relatable, the issues or the to people in Aotearoa.
You know, I don't know. It's just something I have been I'm not even sure. It's such a good question. Why? But I really like do come back to the television as this kind of like site of I don't know. Not, you don't want to say trauma, but the television is this, like my friend Tavia Nyong'o once talked about how it's only after the end of the ubiquity of television that we could see how ghostly it was, like how haunting it is that this image is beamed into everybody's living room and that tells you like what the world is. And I think for Pacific people, maybe Māori and Pacific people, like the television when I was growing up was programmed to like hate us. Like the depictions were awful or whatever. And I've been like, and then also it's this place of extreme violence, right? You see violence on the news. You see the reality of the world on the news or something. And so I just have been in a number of works thinking about that site, thinking about that haunting, thinking about what my relationship could be to the actual lives of people behind the screen. Thinking about the ways, like it's funny you talk about underscore human and that me telling you that. There's a scene in a film I made which is a recording of an artwork by Donald Rodney, which is a small, very fragile house made of his skin. And in the course of that film, I record like a kind of camera movements around it, make a kind of architectural study, but it's only 2 centimeters, it's only got a footprint of like 2 centimeters squared. It's a really tiny object, but I shoot it with a kind of like setup that made it a very large projection. And one of the things the camera does is like when I learn how to use the MOCO, the motion controlled camera rig, was that like actually his wife, Donald's passed on, but his wife, a widow, she talked about how she saw this shooting, this viral police video, and it was of the police killing a young black man, I think Stephon Clark in Sacramento. And the helicopter flies around the house. And she just told me that the house in that infrared or whatever you call it, thermal imaging looked like Donald Skin house artwork. And so I took that from YouTube and realized that the helicopter data was in the, like the coordinates of the helicopter were recorded. And then so I just put them into my camera and we reenacted that. But nobody knows that in the watching of the film. And I think, like, with this, with these works, like, I'm not trying to remediate television. I was just starting to think about that it could be a very, like, what was I thinking? Yeah, I don't know, like, I'm interested in what kids watch and what other, like, I'm interested in TikTok, and I'm interested in, like, the image making that is considered, like, lowbrow, quite honestly. And I thought it would be interesting with these works to break the kinds of, like, rules that we get used to in the art world around video art, like, or video art or cinema within a gallery tends to want to address duration and attention. And these are ideas that I am interested in as well, but it just seemed like, what would it be to try to match the democratic nature of Matiki Mai? That's kind of complicated because it's not strictly a democracy that's being advocated in that document. But I mean, like, it's really accessible. It really cares about people power. And couldn't that, as a kind of mode of filmmaking, come into the image? Like, a sort of taste be damned. Like, I like how these films look, but I don't think they look like art films in any kind of way.
Oh, they so do. I'm gonna call you out on that one.
Well, whatever, you can't get rid of your own thumbprint, but like, yeah. That was kind of where television came in. Also, like, little things, like, I find it really interesting that, like, Leon Narby and people like that, like, Elam grads, started filming the Land March and making, like, experimental footage of protest. Like, I think that's quite cool. There's also quite a lot of, like, kind of experimental TV from the States, like Black television or Native television, that came out of free cable channels. And so there's, like, there is a kind of history of decolonial TV.
Multi-TV?
Yeah. Which, like, was also a protest, right? Like, came directly out of that. So, yeah, that, it seems like the right language for the subject.
Yeah, I think you said maybe it's the absence of the protagonist that's in the media. And that kind of, I guess, this is this question. Maybe there's, why hasn't a Māori artist made this work? What does it feel, why are you making this work instead of a Māori artist making this work?
That's actually like a question I've been asked many times in my career, and I think I am a kind of cultural imposter in lots of ways. And I don't really know how to answer that. Like, I don't really have an alibi to that type of question, because why? No one really knows why they are the ones holding the camera, right? Like, I think as an artist, you go to what feels like the most pressing. Like, I don't even think you have that much control over it, right? Like, you go to something that feels alive to you, that is, that has a magnetic quality to you. And I don't really feel like you get to choose what that is. I mean, often that can be not exactly who you are, right? You might have some kind of adjacent relationship to it. it seems like, I don't really feel like it is for me to say, but it feels like there is something obvious about why, like, Nathan Porhio, when I talked to him about this series, once said, like, yeah, it's great, you can do it, man. Because, like, yeah, you don't have any... If I was to do it, it would be like Naitahu is like doing it. And that means, you know, like I don't have a horse in the immediate race. Is that the metaphor I'm going for? Yeah, I don't have a horse in the fight, a dog in the fight. I don't have those allegiances. I actually have this different type of allegiance, which is like, I basically think if Matsiki Mai doesn't occur, then the Pacific is done for. Like, there will be so much mass dispossession from the Pacific. I can already see in Fiji how much land is lost going to those areas and being there through a climate event. Like, yeah, I think I've talked about before, but we used to as a family send money to Fiji. Like, it felt like it was I remember it because it was a kind of a fight between my parents, but it used to happen every 3 years, and now cyclones happen like 9 times a year, and so like the relocation will be massive. And you know, look at the state of the political world today. Like, do you think it's credible that if large numbers of Pacific people began arriving in boats to this country, like, the country would let us drown? Like, it's already letting us drown. So I do think, like, in some ways, we have, Māori and Pacific people have, again, this shared fate. And so maybe I would say my entry into having a claim to talk about Matsiki Mai, like, I don't think I have a right to make this work. I think I have a claim to this, a claim perhaps, a kind of, you know, an establishment of something that could be a right. And that's through that shared fate. And that's because also this question of the system, there are absolutely components that are for Māori, I think, alone to do and think about, but it's a system that would never work without everybody thinking about and operating. It actually can't be only the question of Māori artists to imagine this work.
Yeah, I think it's that key. The real key is Matsiki Mai. We have to, it's not talking about Māori doing it alone. It's about everyone, and to use the term that kind of gripes me, to be a good treaty partner, to really do co-governance, to really remember that the whakapapa of Māori is Te Moana Nui Ākiwa, and that it isn't Māori and Pacifica as two abject indigenous fighting for our rights is together. These works are speaking to that. For me, it's a really strong reminder of, and I can see the importance of why you're holding the Dako and making these two seminal works. The second work, which we're not seeing, but I think is really key that they're showing alongside, is Soro. It was commissioned by Ngutu Kaka. And what I really liked yesterday was two different stories. One was this image of your father swimming back into Aotearoa. And the second one was you telling me a little bit about what where sort of came from in it being a pun, so.
Yeah, this second film, the second chapter, Soro, is a kind of reimagining or imagining a fictitious event. We're on the anniversary of Jacinda Ardern's Dawn Raid apology. A second apology would be made that attempts to make up for the shortcomings of the first. That's more or less the premise. And the work comes out of my I think in some ways actually like continuing just the thinking around Matsuki Mai. Like it is kind of a meditation on the foreign policy of Matsuki Mai. So that was how my co-writer of this script kind of began the project. Is like he's a lawyer, and I commissioned him to make a set of kind of recommendations, almost to like write a draft that was sort of like we're thinking about reorientating the foreign policy of Aotearoa in the future towards something more Matiki Mai. What would our relationship to the Pacific, wider Pacific, be? But the work comes out of this more personal place where I received money from, it's called the New Dawn Funding Initiative, but it was like literally a part of Jacinda Ardern's reparations package for the Dawn Raids. And like that's quite a burden to receive that kind of funding. You know, like, I had to go for that money, I felt, because I didn't know, like, any other artist who had parents who lived through that time. Like, my dad was quite old, like, relatively old, you know, to my age. And he lived through that period, and he was arrested or nearly arrested a number of times. And he wasn't deported, but he left, I guess, under that threat or under that shadow. And then he came back into Aotearoa by getting a job on a fishing boat or stowing away in that sense, and then swimming into the country. So he lived undocumented for like 10 years. And he wouldn't, he didn't really talk about that. Like, so he didn't really talk about his life anyway. And he was a difficult person, and that was not the only trauma that he endured. When I think about a work like Soro, I think about the need of the Pacific community to be free of the Dawn Raids, but to be free also of the cops in their heads and the militaries in their heads and the kind of like my dad went to a kind of like boarding, native-y boarding school, like that colonial mentality. And anyway, yeah, he swam into the country and for 10 years lived undocumented. And I always wanted to know how they all worked, how they all survived, everyone else who was doing that. And yeah, like as children or whatever, we knew about the Dawn Raids, and we had this like, we were raised very much, even though, yeah, we were kind of like raised to really hate the police, which I think was quite good parenting. And like we were raised with the Dawn Raids, but it was very much like one's own private red zone or something. Like it pertains only to other people around me as a kid or whatever didn't know what they were. And the dawn raids being this thing that were only, felt like they were only known by Pacific people who refused to speak about this event. But then, I think it's different now, but it was like people didn't know that historical event. And then when Jacinda apologized, it was like this searchlight that was placed again onto everybody, because, you know, suddenly something changes at some level because of that. You know, like one way I've been talking about it was that I was in London and I was making work about police violence. And it would have been so useful to be able to say, oh, the Prime Minister apologized to my family for the racial violence we endured. But I could only say that because government magic made it true. I could only say that because, you know, that changes it for you. But you can only, like, why couldn't I say that before? Why didn't I say that before? Why could I not articulate this quite important biographical fact of my father's, but also in a way of mine, to understand my relationship to state violence or state control? And why did it take Jacinda apologizing to make it audible, something speakable? And so this work is a kind of grappling with those things. I'm forgetting the question. Sorrow. What is sorrow? So in her speech, she uses the term sorrow a lot. And this speech is very Christian inflected. And sorrow, you know, like the weeping of the saints or whatever. And sorrow in Fijian, in Vasavakaviti, the isoro is the part of a traditional justice system where you account for your own wrongdoing when you make your address to your community, and it begins a process of repair and reciprocity on behalf of the offended parties. And so there's a way that this work is, yeah, it's a pun, and it's thinking about, it is thinking about that idea of sorrow. You know, I think Alan's performance is full of grace and full of sorrow. But it's also my own, like I'm apologizing too for something in this work somehow.
I'm getting up to the final question. And I thought we could take it two ways. Is this work finished for you? Has reconciliation been found with Soro, with Whakamoemoeā, or what are you, how are you keeping on working on what's upcoming?
Yeah. No, I really think there's another chapter. I think it should be, it's quite useful to say, like to try to drum up enthusiasm by saying it's a trilogy, but then sometimes I think you could just keep making these episodes for each Pacific nation, you know, and like Edith was like, are you gonna do a Samoan one? And I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, maybe. So I think there's one more chapter, and I guess the strong feeling I've had with that chapter is that it should go to a place in the Pacific that the, you know, Matiki Mai doesn't hold, somewhat depends on it, on the, yeah, to go back to co-governance, right? It depends on the co, and it depends in some ways on the moral growth of the other side. Only somewhat, but I think it's worth commenting on. And So I wanted to see what Matsuki Mai might mean in a part of the Pacific where that moral growth is never ever going to happen, like Kanaki or West Papua or places that have really been, whose military occupation as opposed to their settler occupation has been sort of perpetual. And I became really aware in the course of making Soro that we kind of forget our cousins across the colonial language lines or divisions. So that's where I feel like this sci-fi trilogy could go. But the other thing I'm doing, which is difficult to talk about in case it all falls over, is I'm making an election ad for Te Pāti Māori. And that I'm just really interested in really, well, in a way, what I'm thinking about with that work is like what I think about with these works, which is like, how do you make them come true? Like, how do you, I think as an artist, to just believe your work is going to become true is like a useful way to draw energy from it. And yeah, it's like how I guess part of how I keep going.
Well, kia ora, Luke. We're on time, and I thought that if you have a question, you can go and have a coffee again if you need a little top up, and walk up to Luke and ask him. Kia ora, Luke. Thank you for being so generous. And it is once again a real privilege to have these two works here. Mihi.